There are celestial sights more dazzling, spectacles that inspire more awe. But to the thoughtful observer who is privileged to see them well, there is nothing in the sky so profoundly impressive as the canals of Mars. Fine lines and little gossamer filaments only, cobwebbing the face of the Martian disk, but threads to draw one's mind after them across the millions of miles of intervening void. You are listening to Western Worlds on Astronomy.fm. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on Astronomy.fm. My name is Professor Dave, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. Our opening quote was from Percival Lowell's Mars as the Abode of Life from 1908. Lowell is somewhat infamous for creating detailed maps of Mars featuring canals that Martians were using to transport their scarce water. We later realized that he had allowed his enthusiasm to get the better of him. There were no canals. Nonetheless, his enthusiasm was infectious, and we've been obsessed with the idea of life on Mars ever since. And he had a point, too. The question of life on Mars is closely tied to the question of water on Mars, as the main requirement for life might be the presence of water. Today, we'll be learning about the history of Mars, which does include liquid water flowing on the surface, as well as the present and future prospects of water on Mars. To tell us about the waters of Mars, our guest today is Dr. John Mustard from Brown University's Planetary Geosciences Group, who studies the history and processes of climate change on Mars. As we explore the history of water on Mars, don't be afraid to dream a little bit, as Lowell did, about what life on Mars might have been like, and maybe what it might be like in the future. Enjoy the interview by myself, Professor Dave. Dr. Mustard, welcome to Western Worlds. Glad to have you here.
I'm delighted to be here. It's been a wonderful time coming to Western and to the Canadian Space Summit.
To begin with, how about you tell us a little bit about your research interests on Mars?
The research interests on Mars revolve around trying to understand the evolution of water on the planet and how it's been recorded in the geologic materials. And in that, it's been a very exciting time. As we think back 25 years or so, we had evidence that water had been on the planet based on the shape, the morphology of the landforms, but no good evidence based on the mineralogy or the chemistry. But a real revolution has happened in the last 10 years where new types of measurements made with spectroscopy, where we measure the reflected light from surfaces, and with that we can actually determine the fingerprints of key minerals. And the key minerals that we're interested in, the fingerprints of particular importance, are those where water has played a role in its formation. So much like if I were to take a bucket of seawater on the Earth and let it dry out, it would crystallize minerals. And those minerals would have water in their crystal structures. And we could detect that type of mineral that has water in its crystal structure. Now we can do that on Mars.
Is this something we're doing with rovers or with the satellites?
These are something we're doing with satellites today. Rovers do not yet have that type of technology on them. Maybe in the future they will. They have other instruments that can help us figure that out. So by detecting the water-bearing minerals, we've been able to totally transform our understanding of how Mars has evolved with time. And we now know that in the earliest time, the most important hydrated minerals form, those with water. And as time went on, those become less and less frequent or present to the point where today we think they're not really forming anymore at the surface. So that really gives us a timeline to investigate the evolution of water on the planet and the most promising areas we would want to go to explore for habitability.
So when did water disappear on the surface of Mars?
That's an excellent question. I would say that water has not actually disappeared yet. Today, the water on the surface of Mars is frozen. So there is water on the surface of Mars today. It's just frozen. When was it liquid? Well, actually, it appears that it is occasionally liquid, even today. But it's just little sporadic dribbles. So what we're interested in, though, is when was it really abundant? When was it flowing across the surface? And for that, we think it was between 3.5 and 4 billion years ago was when that was happening.
So it's been a little while.
It's been a little while. So this is where I think, okay, if it's not on the surface, yet I know it's frozen on the surface, as I go deeper into the planet, that's where the liquid water may be more present and may have persisted for much longer periods of time.
What are the signs that there may occasionally be liquid water on the surface, even if it's only very sporadic?
I don't know if you've ever been to a construction site after a rainstorm and the piles of sand now show the rivulets that have come down the side of those sand piles. That's what we see in some places on Mars. Rivulets, little channels, which are pretty young. We can tell because of the context or where they sit on the surface, and they have the characteristics that are likely to have formed by flowing water. So we know that happened, but they're small, like the rivulets at a construction site.
Could they be landslides or something else?
They have a sinuosity, in other words, a curvature to their channel pathway, which can't be explained by simple landslides.
So it's got to be a fluid of some sort.
It's got to be a fluid that's behaving as a fluid.
So is this, as you mentioned, hinting at subsurface water, possibly something breaking through the sides of this?
So when these gullies were first discovered in the year 2000, beginning of the century, that was one of the hypotheses, that it was a breakout of an aquifer, so a subsurface water system that broke out onto the surface. Since that time, as we've learned much more about them, an alternative hypothesis, which is really a melting snow or melting ground ice hypothesis, has become much more solidly supported. In other words, the measurements, observations, and models come together more clearly to support ice, snow, and melt.
This is ice on the surface or just under the surface?
Probably just under the surface. Mars has a spectacular seasonal cycle, absolutely spectacular. And about a third of the atmosphere's total weight or mass precipitates out every winter in the North Pole as carbon dioxide snow. And then it does it again in the South Pole through their seasonal cycle. With that, there's also water. And there's a little gradation. The carbon dioxide snow is at the pole, but as you go to mid-latitudes, then carbon dioxide becomes unstable, it's a little too warm, and water ice forms. So it's almost on a seasonal basis you can get snowfall and frost. And then if we go through climate change, Mars has spectacular climate changes over the last millions to hundreds of millions of years. You can actually accumulate glaciers on the volcanoes. We have evidence of that happening. So it is a cold desert, but there's no shortage of water ice moving around. And when you form a pile, that has to then, as climate changes, move. And melting can be part of that. And that's where we think we see really clear evidence of water having formed as a consequence of this ice and snow. And that could be happening today. I think there's quite a bit of evidence that that might be a key source of those really small gullies that we see today.
It's occasionally called a geologically dead world, but it seems quite active still.
Depends on what kind of geology you're interested in, right?
So not so tectonically active.
Geologists come in many flavors, right? There are those with the beards and then those that are clean-shaven, for example. There are those with hats and those without. And so is it geologically active? It is, from an earth science perspective, it has an active water cycle. It has an active atmosphere. It has abundant disturbances on the surface from wind and impact craters. It may have active volcanoes. So I would say it's geologically quiet, but not dead.
Okay. So there is ice, for sure,
right,
in varying amounts. But if we're looking for liquid water, is there a way that we could find it underground?
There are some really interesting techniques that have been developed on Earth to detect subsurface water using the electromagnetic radiation sounding of radar waves, much like you have a radar detector on your car. You could then point that down into the ground. If there's water underground, you can get reflections back due to the water. That's pretty awesome.
So we wouldn't necessarily even have to dig or anything.
Exactly. You could see it would be there. So because of the potential of that happening, two experiments have been flown from orbit to specifically try and detect aquifers or water bodies under the ground on the surface of Mars, or under the surface of Mars. And they have detected what we call reflectors. The radar waves get underground, and if they hit a reflecting surface, they send a signal back. We've detected reflectors. We know the system works. It has totally revealed the shape of the polar caps. There are two polar caps on Mars, and they've just revealed spectacular things. So in other words, the experiments worked, but they did not detect any indications of buried water bodies, like a water table, like you would drill to put in your well for your home, for example. So that has thrown us all into a new phase of thinking. Well, okay, is it because there is no subsurface water, or could the subsurface water be just so low abundance that it actually doesn't form a groundwater table?
So not huge aquifers, but maybe little puddles?
Or maybe just a wedding zone, a wedding front. Like if you take a paper towel and you stick it in the water, you'll notice the water kind of creeps its way up. But it's in a very kind of low abundance, and it kind of just dampens the cloth. Well, if Mars was like that, there's water at depth and it wicks its way up, it could be that that doesn't present an interface that could be detected with our instruments.
But there could still be substantial amounts.
Could be absolutely substantial amounts, and certainly a sufficient amount to sustain a biosphere. Sustain microbes, for example.
Do we think that Mars was habitable in the past and sustained such a biosphere?
Oh my goodness, yes. So was Mars habitable in the past? I think many of us believe the answer to that question is yes. How habitable? What were the nature of those habitats? Are there habitats? That's kind of where we're looking at. So I like to think of habitability as almost a three little bears question. You know, is it too hot, too cold, just right? And if we think about what does life need in almost a naive but realistic way, there are three things that you need to have available to establish a habitability for life. First of all, you need water. You can't have too much water or else it's too dilute. You can't have too little water because it's just too sticky and dry. So somewhere in there, there's a sweet spot for water.
Moderation in everything then?
Absolutely. Don't get too drunk on that water. And then there's nutrients. We need the building blocks of life, etc., to be able to survive. And likewise on that, too many nutrients are toxic and too little nutrients, you can't sustain life. And the third thing that's really important is an energy source. That could be sunlight, or it could be the chemical bonds within minerals and other compounds in the earth that can be used to generate energy. We benefit from the sun, which creates a biosphere which we use for our energy source.
There's some life forms under the ocean that use geological heat sources.
Absolutely, and they use the chemical energy. So the geologic heat sources create particular chemical compounds that organisms can break apart and get the energy. It's fantastic. So we're looking for this sweet spot, which is the wetness, nutrients, and energy sources. Those three things, you can think of them, have to come together to create what we think of as a habitable environment. Now, do we know exactly what that is? Do we know how that fits together? I think that's where we are now today with the Mars Exploration Rover and the Curiosity Rover on Mars today, trying to understand whether those components can be identified and we can zero in and say, aha, this was a habitable environment.
Of course, we only really know the one example of a place where life evolved. So.
Correct. And life the life that evolved here, as we learn more and more about it, oh my gosh, the limits to life, I think we don't know them yet. So when I talk about the sweet spot, it's, again, as you say, it's partially based on our experience on the Earth because we only have one place where we know where life exists. But then as we learn more and more about that, we expand the habitability parameter space, if you will, where we can imagine life could exist.
And Mars was a lot warmer and wetter during its early life.
Yeah. How warm and how wet? That's... We believe it was warmer simply because there's evidence for lake systems, chains of lakes, which were connected by rivers. And that certainly cannot happen today. But how long was that sustained? Was it a brief flowering? That's one of those things. Just a flowering, this brief tens of hundreds of millions of years, where it was warm enough to sustain that. And then it shut down and went back to the cold, dry place like Antarctica.
So if there was life during that time, even if it was a brief time, could it have survived to the modern day?
Life is tenacious. So where would the life have existed under that scenario? If the life were a subsurface type organism living in the warm hydrothermal environments, it could survive today. If it was, however, a surface dwelling organism, probably not, because you don't maintain the sweet spot. But life is tenacious, and if life were to develop on Mars the same as it did on the Earth, it would evolve, adapt, and perhaps persist. But I think the happy spots today on Mars, the places where you would want to go and spend some time as an organism are probably subterranean. It would still be a tough life, right? It'd be hard to find enough to eat, hard to make sure you got enough water, but, you know, life is tenacious.
So to find that stuff, would we have to dig?
That's an interesting question. Would we have to dig to find that stuff? So I guess I would say if the pathway of exploration continues to show us evidence that there maybe once was constituents of life no longer on the surface that might prompt one to start to dig. And you would choose places where you wouldn't have to dig too deep because it's expensive and complicated, and maybe we could find particular places we could do that. But I think that's a really interesting way for the exploration. But maybe we could let nature do the digging for us. And what I mean by that is meteorite impacts are phenomenally efficient hole drillers, right? They can drill holes tens of kilometers deep. It's just a little violent.
So we can look within impact craters and see if there are any different signs there.
Absolutely. There's some really interesting impact craters that look like they may have had circulating hot water hydrothermal systems, which have left their traces. And those would be a place where we could go and see if the signs of life were retained. As we go further and try and understand the exploration of signs of life, right? Seeking signs of life. That's a very difficult challenge, but exciting. And some of the criteria you need to think about is how do you concentrate and preserve organic compounds, those that would be part of these seeking signs of life. And that is really the trick. Concentrate and preserve over the periods of time necessary for us to go and analyze. And places like hot springs are particularly interesting for that perspective because they get encapsulated in siliceous sinter, the silica formations that come out of hot springs. The organic compounds can be trapped for later analysis, and they get protected. They get protected from ionizing radiation and the harsh environments there.
So we'd have to look fairly hard to find the life now, but what about in the future? Could it ever be made more habitable or simply become more habitable for us even?
That's actually interesting because the sun as a solar type star, maybe you could tell me more about where we are in the solar evolution there as an astronomer, but stars go through a particular evolution and the solar system star has been warming up through time. And maybe if we wait another 3 billion years, the sun's output will increase another 30%, let's say. That could make Mars very habitable for us.
At which point we pretty much have to go there because the Earth would be far less habitable.
Yeah, the Earth would be engulfed by its own. Exactly. So maybe we look for the staging in there. In terms of the geoengineering, planetary engineering, I'm not sure how one would go about that. I mean, just whether or not we understand the planetary system sufficiently that if we released several hundreds of megatons of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, would that generate a warm atmosphere, right? I'm not sure how we could do that. I'm sure we could do it from an astronaut exploring point of view and carrying our habitable environment with us. But whether we can make the planet habitable, that's interesting. I don't know.
It would be a large task even if we knew how to do it.
Oh my gosh, yes. I mean, we're doing a good job of geoengineering this planet, unintentionally perhaps, and we'll get to see the outcome in the next 100 years. Maybe it's not, you know, to geoengineer that back will be a significantly large challenge as well.
What do you think our next step would be in the exploration of Mars?
Where we are today in the exploration of Mars is one in which we've done phenomenal observations from orbit of the morphology, structure, and characteristics of the landscapes. We're making huge progress in understanding what the chemical and mineralogic makeup is of the planet. And we're getting more information daily on the climate and the atmosphere and the dynamics over time. And we're moving to the surface with, for example, the Curiosity rover is the next step in that pathway. So where should we go next? I believe that sample return has the potential to transform our understanding of the planet in a way that no other method of exploration can do today.
Would we have to send people to bring these samples back?
Not necessary to send people. What we could do is continue to send rovers with advanced instrumentation and the ability to encapsulate and cache samples in a container that could be put onto a launch vehicle, sent into orbit, captured, and returned. And it would absolutely transform our understanding of the planet. As curiosity will transform our understanding, there's only so far we can go with current technology, with instrumentation that could be space qualified and made robust enough to survive that long on another planet. Once the samples get back here, the kind of laboratories here, such as the University of Western Ontario, are absolutely going to give you much more insight. The laboratories that take up a whole floor, for example, of the buildings here, we can't yet understand how to miniaturize that. And it allows us to repeat experiments and take another look and follow up rapidly on our analyses. So I think sample return is the next step towards the question of habitability. I'm not convinced that I know where I would want to return that sample from. And today, Curiosity has gone to a layered sedimentary site with the right combination of minerals we see from orbit that will allow us to better understand this habitability question. But there are many potential habitable environments. And does Gale Crater, where Curiosity is, represent the habitable environment that would be the most promising for sample return? In my mind, the jury is still out, and I think there's lots of reasons to continue to explore. So we've been to a number of places on the surface of Mars, and it'll be incredibly exciting to understand what comes back from the Curiosity's analyses of Gale Crater.
It sounds like it's a bright future in terms of Mars exploration, still a lot to do.
Bright future, and I think it's going to require international cooperation to make it work, because the technological challenges are huge, but also the international interest is huge. And I think through cooperation, we can better able to afford and achieve that goal.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for coming out. It's been great to have you here.
My pleasure. It's a delight to speak to you, and let's on to Mars.
You are listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So we just listened to Dr. Jack Mustard's interview talking about the history of water on Mars, and it's quite an interesting history that we're not entirely 100% sure of, but it looks like a lot happened on Mars and is still happening.
Now, this is a favorite topic when I go into schools because, of course, everyone hears all these things that are in the news, which, of course, are rarely correct. So, you know, they think that there's blowing water on Mars, or they think the complete opposite, in that there's been no evidence of water found. It's interesting to teach them that it's actually somewhere in between, that there is evidence of past water flow, both with the geological formations and with the chemical analysis they've been doing more recently, but that there's no liquid water flow. So it's interesting to hear his explanations on what they're doing now in order to find evidence of water and potentially of life as well.
Yeah, it's interesting to try and tease together all these different lines of investigation. We have large landforms that look like there's been flow, and then we have rocks that look like they formed next to water, and then we have minerals that had to have formed with water next to them. So that's pretty suggestive.
There's lots of indications, but
yeah.
We've not yet had a rover actually dip its wheel in a puddle or something.
That's right. Apparently the type of evidence what we need.
Yeah.
Right?
Although, as he says, you know, with the very high resolution imagery that we can get with things like high-rise camera now, you know, they're seeing gullies, which is a controversial term, I gather. Rivulets, he calls them, where maybe there has been some melting of subsurface ice or some kind of expression of water that has flowed down the side of a crater or something. I see these now and then, suggesting that maybe even there is actually somehow almost an active water cycle in the subsurface today. Maybe.
And they're very careful, right,
yeah,
to make sure that they don't say that they're like, well, but I did find it interesting that he was talking about how there are these little tiny instances of evidence of current liquid water in very, very tiny quantities.
Mm-hmm. I think where people really, really get confused is the fact that Mars has polar ice caps. So they have water ice.
Yeah, we know it's got ice.
Yeah, we know it has got ice. So I think the direct implication what general public has is to have water, because they don't understand, you know, how there is pressure and temperature and everything is interrelated. I think they would generally relate to the idea of having water there, just because there is water ice and carbon dioxide ice, right? But it is very hard, as you mentioned, you know, just to say there is water on Mars. And yeah, there has been a lot of speculations in the media about we'll soon mm-hmm. enough find water and we'll soon enough find life forms that
we've been expecting
beneath.
It for so long,
yeah.
Too. It seems like a lot of people just take it for granted. Haven't we done that yet?
Yeah.
We found the ice.
You know, it took 3,000 years to work out the laws of motion, I'm sure that we can time to find life on Mars.
On another planet,
on a different
too.
Planet, yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
We can give that a little while.
Yeah. But, you know, if you can speculate all you want, even if we were to find water, and we found it in solid form, right? We know that it's there in some gaseous form at very low amounts, and we've seen it from the lines of investigation I mentioned before, from the subsurface hydrogen that we detect from orbit and from the ground now. When Phoenix landed, it blew away the dirt and found ice underneath, right? It's there, but is it interacting with anything else, or is it just locked up in a solid form? It's not really a question of, is there dihydrogen monoxide? Is it there? We know it is. The question is, does it participate in the current geological and hydrological cycle?
Yeah, and of course, it's not going to be terribly busy on the surface. Even if it's there, then there's probably only small amounts. But I find it really interesting, the idea of the subsurface water, where there could be a lot more. There could be harboring microbes or something that are left over from possibly billions of years ago. Just, I think, last week, there was a news story where we found microbes living in a lake, well, an under ice lake in Antarctica that had been there for 2,800 years, isolated, mm-hmm. and they still survive. So could that happen on Mars as well?
Yeah, how long can those kind of little remnant colonies hang on and subsist in harsh environments?
Right, I mean, he said life is very
tenacious,
right? And they mentioned we've been finding life in all sorts of places we never thought would exist, right? I mean, the bottom of the ocean floors and volcanic vents, and now in lakes that have been frozen over for thousands of years, you know, there's no reason to think that life couldn't sustain itself in that kind of environment.
On the one hand, this is a fabulous daydream, right? That, like, life started somehow on Mars because it was warm and wet.
Wouldn't it be great if there was life on the planet right next to us? That would be very convenient for us.
That would be great. But, well, wouldn't it be fabulous if it was just persisting, just waiting for 2 billion years, just hiding a meter under the surface?
Hold on, guys. The humans are almost here.
That's right. But a meter under the surface might as well be a mile under the surface, unless you've got a pretty fancy drilling system. The difficulties of doing things robotically on Mars are surprising, even to people who are familiar with robotics. You can't just go with a shovel and dig and then look and say, oh, look, there's a layer of green endoliths here. Why they would be green underground, I don't know. But there are plans to send missions with drills. But making something with a drill that can go down even a meter is a real challenge.
And then what if it's really 1.1 meters you need to go down?
That's right. Yeah. That's right. It's a meter and a half, and now what?
Yeah. Now we have to send a whole new mission.
Yeah.
I think that's the whole reason why people are waiting for a human mission to Mars, because, yeah, we have robotics, you know, they can do what we tell them to do, but there is, like, a limit to what they can do, you know, being so far away with the limited amount of, you know, machinery they have, you know, there might be something they look at, but they might not know, and, like, the machine might not be designed to, you know, detect something, but humans' eyes can detect a lot more than what a robot would, right?
If we can send people, then we can send a lot of equipment with them. We're going to have to if we want them to survive. And if they've got a shovel, a human with a shovel is a pretty versatile object, right? They could get down a meter and a half given enough time and some food, maybe.
Yeah. There's a great many achievements have been made by humans with shovels. But it's, of course, if we send humans shovels or not, they're going to go with bacteria.
That's right.
And when we detect microbes on Mars, we will detect on any human mission, we will find microbes.
Yeah.
The question is whether we brought them there or not.
Of course, we already try to be careful about making sure that we don't contaminate Mars with the stuff that we are sending. But yeah, that'll be an issue.
That's going to be a real
challenge.
I think
we're already contaminating Mars with all the rovers that we have already sent.
Yeah,
they
make some effort to isolate them inside. Yeah. They've stopped sterilizing spacecraft altogether.
So there might be something still floating on there. We just don't know if it's actually from Earth or if it's a Martian life.
Yeah. And that stuff is pretty hardy. Did they not find... Well, I guess it was controversial, but they thought that they found some microbes on hardware that landed on the moon and then was brought back by Apollo. One of the missions that landed next to, like, an old robotic surface probe, and they brought back a camera or something. And then, of course, the questions are, did that stuff survive on the moon? Or did we contaminate it on the way back?
Yeah, of course, if we find life and it ends up being terrestrial life that was just brought along, well, that might not be terribly exciting. But the truth is, if we can find microbes that can survive very well on Mars, if we contaminate it and the life survives for, you know, a reasonable amount of time, well, that's actually pretty interesting too, right? Mm-hmm. It's not going to be an intentional science experiment on that level, but it would be quite interesting to find out that we can put stuff on Mars that could survive there, because life is hardy on Earth. Can it survive on Mars, and could we possibly use that? That could possibly be one step in terraforming the world.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Parshadi Patel and Michael Forrester. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Alyssa Gilbert, Raymond Francis, Dave Kirsch, and Parshadi Patel. This episode was hosted, edited, and featured an interview by myself, Dave Kirsch. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes, or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, www.cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are @WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are www.facebook.com/westernworlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you can join us again next week, right here on astronomy.fm.